With the fall of La Rochelle in 1628, the Huguenots were really finished as a political and military force capable of defying the crown. And thereafter, the pressure on the Huguenot minority only tightened. The Edict of Nantes was now given the strictest and most restrictive possible interpretation in French courts, and a steady erosion of the civil rights of the Huguenots followed. They were excluded from public office, they were excluded from guilds, and even in Protestant towns, Catholic magistrates were often imposed by the crown. Moreover, the crown made fairly lavish use of material incentives like bribes and titles and lands to encourage conversion, and this was accompanied by a Catholic religious revival, which I think we have to say formed the basis of an intellectual and spiritual counterattack by the Catholic majority against the Protestant minority. We see the multiplication of Catholic confraternities, that is to say, groups of lay people who get together for religious purposes. There's an outpouring from French presses of Catholic religious literature, both devotional and controversial, that is to say, attacking Protestantism. There was, moreover, at the same time, a fairly dramatic improvement in the training of the Catholic clergy, in its preparation, in its discipline, and in its energy. And the ultimate result of all of these pressures on the Huguenot population was a steady atrophy in their numbers. Now, at the same time that the crown was consolidating religious uniformity throughout France, it was also extending its own secular powers. And indeed, I think it has to be said that the two went together. Increasing the power of the Catholic religion went hand in hand with increasing the power of the French crown. At the same time, however, this expansion of the secular power of the French crown was ridden with what I think we have to call contradictory tendencies. That is to say, the very means which were used to centralize the authority themselves put limits on what the crown could actually do. And this dual process of an expansion of the crown's authority and yet the contradictions which somehow limit it or undermine it can be traced throughout all of the arms of the state. And I'd like to follow that process in four key areas: the law, the military, provincial administration, and finally, crown finance. The judicial system, or the judiciary, was really one of the oldest functions of all European kings, this function of resolving disputes, of pronouncing justice. And during the early 17th century, it became fairly common in France for the crown to introduce new courts where older courts refused to ratify its proposals, whether fiscal or otherwise. In the year 1629, Cardinal Richelieu, who was the chief minister to the French king, introduced the so-called Code Michaud and forced the Parlement of Paris, the highest court in the land, to register this this code after a seven-month filibuster. That is to say, the Parlement resisted, knowing what this meant in terms of an increase of royal power, but in the end was forced to yield to the pressure of the crown. And the Code Michaud had a lot of revealing provisions. It provided for the creation of special judicial commissions in the provinces, and these commissions were often nothing more than panels of judges who had been handpicked to solve political problems by Richelieu himself. And of all these chambers, as they were called, the most notorious was something called the Chambre de l'Arsenal, the Chamber of the Arsenal, which was active between 1631 and 1643. And this court rapidly became a vehicle for dispensing summary justice, above all to political offenders, to the enemies of the crown on political grounds. The Chambre de l'Arsenal's disregard for the status and privilege of those arrested and its disregard for legal norms soon became legendary, and it generated an awful lot of protest. The crown also began making increasing use of a practice called évocation in France, that is to say, the removal of selected lawsuits from the jurisdiction of the various parlements, these traditional prestigious courts, and transferring them to more compliant, newer royal courts. Technically speaking, évocation was legal, since everybody agreed that the king was ultimately the font, of all justice, and that royal courts were only supposed to enforce his judgment. Nevertheless, there was a fairly widespread feeling that évocation and these special legal commissions created by Richelieu were really contrary to custom and to the spirit of justice. But despite all of this evidence of judicial arbitrariness, these handpicked tribunals, this habit of circumventing the traditional courts, the very fact that we see the crown operating in this way, trying to circumvent its own courts, I think is fairly significant. Because it shows us how courts themselves, even though created by the crown, could become the foundation of a local elite, a vehicle for bureaucratic obstruction, and for the defense of local custom and privilege. Moreover, I think it's also worth stressing the importance of venality of office, this practice whereby the French crown would sell offices in the machinery of the state to buyers with capital. it's important to look at see venality of office as a kind of process which would ultimately create vested interests within the very institutions which were intended to serve the interests of the crown, so that people ended up owning a piece of the state and might not want to have it used in a way against their own interests, no matter what the crown itself would say.